Hello, I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. Tonight, we will discuss the field of neuro-oncology. This is the field that pertains to both malignant and non-malignant tumors that can affect the brain, spine, or spinal cord. And as you know, Health Matters is a weekly live show here on Red River Radio where we invite you, our listeners, to join the discussion. We'll take your calls tonight at 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. We have three guests tonight. We have coordinated schedules in departments of neuro-oncology, radiation oncology, as well as medical oncology to get three experts here tonight. We have Dr. Simeon Missios, Assistant Professor, Department of Neurosurgery here at Louisiana State University School of Medicine in Shreveport. We also have, again, here with us tonight on Health Matters, Dr. Ben Wilkinson, a radiation oncologist with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. And we have with us tonight Dr. Chip MacDonald, medical oncologist, also with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center here in Shreveport. Again, this is Health Matters on Red River Radio. The topic tonight is neuro-oncology. We're going to be talking about brain tumors, both malignant and benign, and tumors of the spine and spinal cord. Dr. Missios, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Randy. It's good to be here.
What do you see as the major issue with tumors of the brain and spinal cord that you see as a neurosurgeon?
So one of the greatest challenges as being a neurosurgical oncologist is always to try and achieve the balance. The goal of typically the first step in any management of this disease is to obtain tissues just so that the pathologist can tell us exactly what type of tumor that we're dealing with. And all the subsequent treatment for the patient, which typically involves chemotherapy and radiation, is dependent on the diagnosis. So typically the surgeon is one of the first physicians to treat these patients. And there's always the challenge of taking out, of resecting as much tumor as it is possible, but we always have to balance that against the risks of the operation and the morbidity that we can cause. We're dealing with a very high price real estate area, and depending where the tumor is located in the brain or the spinal cord, that is a lot of times the greatest limiting factor in terms of how much we can resect safely.
Yeah, so this is expensive real estate, as
Absolutely.
We say in medicine, so it's not somewhere you want to go and start taking out tissue just because you're curious.
Absolutely, and that means that there's a lot of planning that takes place before the surgery even happens.
Absolutely, and we'll talk a lot more about that as we move forward. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. The number for you to call for questions, it's 1-800-552-8502, and you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Wilkinson, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
What are the most common tumors that affect the nervous system? Are they more benign or are they more malignant?
So when we think about brain tumors, we think about whether they started within the brain or if they've come from a malignant site outside. And the most common reason that someone's going to have a mass within their brain is going to be actually from a distant site, such as lung cancer, breast cancer, colorectal cancer. Once we move past metastatic disease, we start to think about primary brain tumors, and that's where we get into the malignant glial-based tumors such as gliomas, GBMs, which most of our listeners hopefully aren't familiar with, but a brain tumor that is difficult to treat. And then we get into some of the less common ones, such as a meningioma and other less common benign tumors.
And so brain tumors can come from cells that actually didn't originate within the brain, that got there from some other primary site.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's metastatic brain tumors.
Okay. Correct.
And so you mentioned glial cells. What are glial cells?
So glial cells are the support cells within our brain that surround much of the neural tissue, and that's where the difficult diagnosis of a glioma comes from.
And so brain cells themselves, the cells that are actually helping us to think and fire our limbs and sense senses of taste and smell and so on, those aren't the cells that are actually becoming malignant in this sense.
Yeah.
These are cells that are actually, they're supporting the brain, but not actually functioning as nervous tissue?
Exactly. So it's the support cells that we typically see, so such as the ependymal lining, the meningeal lining, these glial cells that tend to be more commonly involved. But, you know, globally as a patient, when you think about a brain diagnosis, it's going to be someone that, you know, a cell within the brain is within the brain, and so we think of a brain tumor.
Sure, absolutely. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. Our number for your calls is 1-800-552-8502. And we are talking about brain tumors and tumors of the spine. And the field is known as neuro-oncology. We have a medical oncologist with us tonight as well. His name is Dr. Chip MacDonald with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. Dr. MacDonald, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks
tonight.
For having me.
What's going on in terms of the incidence and prevalence of brain tumors? Are these becoming more common or less common?
Well, fortunately, they're somewhat rare, at least uncommon, but the incidence or the amount of brain tumors that get diagnosed every year has been on the rise probably for a long time, probably for 40, 50, 60 years. There are several factors that are related to that. Number one is the ease at which these tumors are detected. You know, prior to CAT scans being developed in the 1970s and MRIs in the 1980s, it was probably much more difficult to diagnose a brain tumor. I wouldn't know. I was, and you know, a toddler at that time, I guess. But
yeah, me too.
Yeah, but right. So that's one factor, is the ease of diagnosis. Probably the aging of the population probably has something to do with that. And there probably are some environmental factors that are contributing, although I don't think anything has been specifically pinpointed outside of radiation exposure. People that have been exposed to radiation with, you know, atomic bombs, nuclear reactor accidents, but those are somewhat uncommon circumstances.
Let's go ahead and go to the telephones. We have a caller. We have Carolyn from Shreveport. Carolyn, thank you so much for calling us tonight on Health Matters.
Hi, nice talking to you. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about some of the non-surgical treatments for brain tumors.
Okay, absolutely. Non-surgical treatments. We have two non-surgeons here, but I'm actually going to ask the surgeon what his approach to whether or not a patient is a candidate for surgery if they're diagnosed with a brain tumor.
Okay, and if it's all right, I'll just hang up and listen.
Thank you so much for calling us tonight.
Thank you.
So one of the main, surgery has two main goals, and the first step is to establish the diagnosis, to establish what type of tumor that we're dealing with. Radiology has gotten much better, and especially the MRI technology has gotten so much better over the past few years, so we can have a decent idea what we're dealing with, but we still need to obtain tissue diagnosis to guide the patient's treatment. The second role of surgery is what we technically call tumor debulking, or try to reduce the tumor burden, meaning that trying to remove as much tumor as we can. Because the less tumor we leave behind, the better it is for chemotherapy and and radiation, the less tumor that those treatments have to deal with. The determination of how much tumor we can resect depends on the location of the tumor. So, for example, if a tumor is located very deep within the brain, then surgery may not be possible. Similarly, if a tumor is located in areas of the brain that are what we call eloquent, such as areas that control speech or areas that control movement or vision, surgery may not be possible. And in those cases, what we do is a brain biopsy, which can be done with minimal morbidity, and we can safely remove small pieces of this brain tumor that we can look at under the microscope. Obviously, in areas that are much safer, that allow us to do wider resections, the goal is to remove as much of the tumor as we can.
Dr. Wilkinson, you know, I would imagine radiosurgery would be something that would be fairly common. Is that actual surgery, or is that a combination of radiation and surgery? How does that play into the non-surgical treatment of some of these tumors?
So radiosurgery is definitely a misnomer. The fact that surgery's in the title, most people get afraid that there's going to be some sort of cutting involved or something like that. But definitely in the sense that it's a partnership between the neurosurgeon and the radiation oncologist, plus medical physicist. Both Dr. Mizios and I are trained in gamma knife stereotactic radiosurgery, which is a technique that we offer here in Shreveport, one of the many centers around the country. And it's a way that we are able, whether we have the pathology first or potentially in the case of a benign process such as a meningioma, potentially we may be able to offer the non-invasive treatment right up front. Radiosurgery tends to be for smaller lesions, and the same component about talking about the expensive real estate goes into play with radiosurgery as well. There are sensitive parts of the body and the brain that we're not able to give as high of a dose as we'd like to.
So non-surgical treatments, that was a good question from Carolyn. Dr. McDonald, when you think about medical treatments of these tumors, what is the role of medical treatment in terms of chemotherapy? Does chemotherapy actually get into the brain and treat some of these tumors?
Yes and no. Traditionally, we were taught that chemotherapy does not get into the brain. There's something called the blood-brain barrier, and that is something that I suppose is there to protect our brains from toxic chemicals and things like that. And since chemotherapy is a toxic chemical, that blood-brain barrier tries to prevent the chemotherapy from getting into the brain. We do use some chemotherapy, mostly right now in conjunction with radiation to treat these primary brain tumors. The main drug that we use is a drug called Timodar, which is a chemotherapy agent that's actually comes in a pill, so it's an oral chemotherapy. Patients are generally fairly excited about that. Very, very well tolerated, not what you think of traditionally with chemotherapy in terms of side effects. And that has been shown to improve response rates and survival over radiation alone. In terms of beyond that, there are a couple of drugs such as Avastin, Irinotecan, a couple of others that do have some role in treating these primary malignant brain tumors.
So predominantly the malignant tumors are what you would give the Timodar and some of the other chemotherapy.
Exclusively, yeah, that's right.
So benign tumors are not treated with chemotherapy and more likely to be treated by non-surgical means such as radiation treatment in a small lesion, maybe in an important part of the brain or in an accessible part of the brain such as meningioma, like you were speaking of, the bigger ones. Okay, the next question we had was texted in. What is the difference between gamma knife and tomotherapy? And I'm thinking, Dr. Wilkinson, that would be a question that would be right up your alley.
Sure. So there's different platforms that we can deliver radiosurgery, or for that matter, radiation in general. And to explain that, we'll back up a little bit and say that most radiation is delivered in the form of a photon, which is a standard X-ray. There's additional types of radiation that can be delivered either intracranially in the form of brachytherapy, such as a type of liquid material that is radioactive or potentially implantable sources, and then external beam radiation, which would either be photons such as gamma knife or tomotherapy, or potentially even proton therapy, which was one of the first forms of radiosurgery. I like to think about it, and the way I talk to patients about it, it's similar to Ford and Chevy. They're different brands of radiation equipment, and different hospitals will purchase different platforms. When we think about which one is better, it really depends on the area that we're treating and the type of tumor. There's some terrific benefits to each of the platforms, and it's really up to the neurosurgery and radiation oncology team to come up with the best option. What's great about for patients in this area is that we have all of those potential platforms. We have gamma knife, we have tomotherapy, we have proton therapy, and it's very unique. You know, what I also say to patients is major cities like Dallas, San Francisco, Denver do not have all three platforms in one place, and so it's a real blessing to have all that here.
Is there an advantage actually of proton therapy? You know, I understand it's, you know, it causes less damage to tissue as it gets to where it needs to go. Is there an advantage of proton therapy over conventional radiotherapy in these cases?
You know, definitely over conventional radiotherapy. You know, the benefit with protons is as we increase in the target size and the volume, as well as the location. And for listeners that aren't familiar with proton therapy, it is a type of particulate radiation that travels into the body. And because it has mass, it interacts with density as it travels, and it stops suddenly and delivers all of its dose at the end of its path. So what you can think about is a very low dose going into the body and then delivering its dose at its target without any exit dose. Anyone who's ever had an x-ray before knows that you know, the radiation travels all the way through you. That's how we normally get imaging, medical imaging. And so what's unique about protons is that they will travel in and they are able to stop at its target. The downside of proton is that, you know, as you travel into the body, you have to give a little bit of a higher entrance dose. And so sometimes we'll have patients with a little bit more of entry side effects. Also, our imaging to be able to deliver proton therapy right now is not at the same level as tomotherapy, for example, or potentially gamma knife, as being as precise. That's something that's being updated. And so we'll have the first cone beam CT scan for a pencil beam single unit here delivered in Shreveport in September.
What is that? What's a cone unit for CAT scanning?
It allows us to have a CT scan in the treatment room. It's something that's going to be available on future iterations of Gamma Knife, the Gamma Knife Icon, which is being developed right now. And it just allows us to be sure that what we've planned is exactly what's being delivered in the treatment room, which is a very nice thing.
This is listener-supported Red River Radio, and this is Health Matters, the live weekly radio show where we invite you to join our discussion of important healthcare topics. The question for your calls or comments, it's 1-800-552-8502. I'm your host tonight. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. We have three guests tonight. We have a neurosurgeon, Dr. Simeon Missios with Louisiana State University School of Medicine here in Shreveport in the Department of Neurosurgery. We have radiation oncologist Dr. Ben Wilkinson here at the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center, as well as medical oncologist Dr. Chip McDonald. Dr. Missios, let's say a patient has gotten an image and there's concern that there could be a malignant tumor in their brain, and you're going to do a biopsy of that tumor. Could you walk me through the discussion that you would have with the patient and what that would be like for them, what that experience of a brain biopsy is, because it I think it sounds a little bit scary to a lot of patients to think about having their brain biopsy, but it's not as traumatic as one would believe, right?
Certainly. So I would always go over the imaging with the patient. I think it's very important for the patient to have a visual representation of what that tumor is, what it looks like on the MRI, how big it is in relation to the rest of the brain. And it's once the MRI is explained to someone, it's something that everyone can easily understand. Everyone can grasp their hands around the idea. Then I would explain to them the procedure itself and what the procedure involves. A biopsy is The time of the procedure is about an hour and a half. There's a lot of planning that goes behind it. But what it involves is doing an MRI on the morning of the procedure, and then we use that information to carefully calculate a trajectory that the biopsy needle will go through. We do the procedure is done under general anesthesia, so the patient is asleep. They don't remember any of the procedure. It involves making a very small incision about the width of an inch or smaller, and then passing the needle through at the pre-selected trajectory. We do have to cross the skull to do that, so it involves making a very small hole through the skull. The needle, even though it's called a needle, it's not really sharp like a needle itself. It's a blunt instrument. It's about the size of a strand of spaghetti. And then using a technology we call neuronavigation, which is very similar to a GPS system for the brain. We target the needle at our, again, pre-selected specified target. Typically, we like to pick the middle of the tumor, and we pick a trajectory that does not put any important areas of the brain or any blood vessels in danger. And once we do that, then we send several very small pieces of the tumor to pathology. Patients spend the night in the hospital. They get a CAT scan after the hospital to make sure that there's no bleeding at the area. And the vast majority of them get to go home the next day. The results of the pathology take about half a week to a week until they come out. So we see them in the office a week later and we go over the diagnosis with them.
And so after the biopsy is done, it's not in like a situation where you may get a frozen section or something like that. It's actually something the patients will wait for a final pathologic diagnosis.
Because we're not able to remove a lot of tissue from a biopsy, we send a very small amount for a frozen section, which may or may not give us an idea about what type of tumor we're dealing with. Frozen section is a very crude assessment, so we use it just to get an idea, but again, we always wait for the final pathology before initiating any further treatment.
Okay, Dr. McDonald, when you're treating a patient and you're concerned that a brain metastasis may be a problem, what's the process that you go through in terms of a patient that you know has a history of a primary type of tumor? What monitoring process do you undergo looking for metastatic brain disease?
So the signs and symptoms that may clue us into that would be a headache, obviously any kind of neurologic deficit, weakness, loss of consciousness, seizure, that's a common presenting symptoms. A lot of patients who develop metastatic brain tumors, their initial problem is vomiting, which is sometimes easy to miss because the patients are also on chemotherapy, and that can also cause nausea and vomiting. Generally, if there is a level of suspicion for metastatic disease to the brain, the best test is an MRI. A lot of times these patients might show up in the emergency department where a CT scan, kind of a simple CT scan without contrast, is done. And that may or may not show a tumor, but certainly an MRI. And at that point, when we do the MRI, depending on the findings, whether the tumor is single or multiple, there's a consideration for getting them to one of these guys on my right or left, either surgery or radiation. A lot of what I do for those patients also is supportive care, trying to take care of symptoms, placing patients on steroids to reduce swelling, to help with the headaches and help with the vomiting, seizure medications, anti-nausea medicines, that sort of thing.
So when a patient has the diagnosis of metastatic brain disease, it's a symptom-based approach. Is that a curable condition generally, or does it depend on the tumor type?
Well, not generally, but we all, I'm sure all of us here on this side of the table have had patients who developed, for example, lung cancer, metastatic to the brain, that are long-term survivors. I know I have a couple of patients in my practice that were diagnosed, presented with a brain mass, were found to have a brain tumor, and at the same time found to have a lung tumor, which turned out to be a lung cancer, which was metastatic to the brain. And we treated the brain with surgery and radiation, treated the lung tumor either with surgery or radiation and chemotherapy, and they're 4, 5, 6 years out, doing well, cancer-free. So it doesn't happen very often, but it is possible.
Are there types of cancer that tend to move to the brain, metastasize to the brain more than others?
Now, lung cancer is probably the most common one we see. Breast cancer does, although it's not common for breast cancer to do that. Breast cancer is a common cancer, so we do see that. Melanoma can do that. Kidney cancers can do that. Essentially, I suppose any cancer can do it, but those are probably some of the ones that we see most commonly.
This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. The topic for tonight is neuro-oncology. The number for your calls, 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Wilkinson, in terms of the imaging of brain tumors, MRI is talked about a lot. Is there a role for PET scans in the imaging of brain tumors? Does that help in your treatment assessment?
So one of the limitations of PET scan is that the FDG glucose that we typically use for PET is taken up in large quantity by the normal brain, and it makes it difficult to distinguish between normal brain and a metastatic disease. That being said, there are other isotopes that you can use with the PET scan that are more of a research application to help identify metastatic disease or primary brain tumors. The place that I use a PET scan with brain protocol, which we do at Willis-Knighton, is being able to distinguish between active disease or radionecrosis. There are times after primary radiation treatment following surgery that we're trying to sort out in between whether or not we have tumor recurrence or if we have a radiation effect, which sometimes can look very similar. There's additional platforms that we use within MRI, such as MR spectroscopy or MR perfusion. And so each of those areas have limitations, and each practitioner has the one that they like better versus other ones based on their experience. But, you know, it's a complex issue that Dr. Mizios could definitely talk to of trying to sort out, you know, when we have radionecrosis versus tumor progression. And there's times when we ask him and some of the other neurosurgeons to get involved to even biopsy or potentially remove an area, or potentially Dr. McDonald to get involved with maybe even Avastin to help with some of the symptoms.
We'll go ahead and take our next caller. We have Shelley from Leesville. Thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Yes, I had a question for the doctor. I've had two glomus jugularis tumors removed in the past 2 years. I'm just wondering, is there any progressive treatment for that type of tumor? How rare are those type of tumors, and how often do they reoccur? And I'll go ahead and hang up and this is the answer. Thank you.
Dr. Mizios.
So we just heard about a patient who had had been diagnosed and underwent surgery for a type of tumor that's called a glomus jugularis tumor. And these are quite complex tumors. They tend to appear at the base of the skull. And what they are is they are tumors, they are remnants of nerve cells that are very closely associated with blood vessels. And typically they appear in areas at the place where the top of the neck meets the base of the skull, behind the ear. Because they are inherently associated with blood vessels, they tend to be very vascular lesions. They are benign. They're not cancer, so they don't spread throughout the body. But as they grow, they can cause local destruction of the bone. They can extend into the area that we call the retropharynx, which is behind our behind the throat, essentially, so they can cause swallowing trouble. And they also grow near areas where the nerve that controls swallowing and the nerve that controls movement of the tongue are, so they can cause trouble with that. Sometimes they can extend into the intracranial cavity as well and start pushing on the most inferior aspect of the brain. Their management is typically a multimodal management. We try, when patients are surgical candidates, we try to remove as much as we can. Because they're so vascular, a lot of times people can undergo an embolization before the surgery. And when these tumors are small or when they cannot be completely removed, a lot of times radiation cannot take place as an adjuvant treatment, as an adjunct. In terms of any new therapies or targeted therapies for these types of tumors, I am not aware of. Again, up to now, when they're small, then radiation can a lot of times freeze them into place so they don't progress. Or when they're big, they require a combination of surgery and radiation.
Has that been your experience, Dr. Wilkinson? Is radiation typically required when they become more aggressive?
Definitely for progressive disease, we really try to do surgery first, and it's one of the areas that Gamma Knife definitely has a role in being able to control these just because of how conformal it is and low down into the skull base.
Thank you so much, Shelley, for your call. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. The number for your call, it's 1-800-552-8502. Dr. McDonald, we had a question that was tweeted in, and the question is, I'm having difficulty with my migraines. And is that a symptom that I might be getting a brain tumor?
It's unlikely.
Migraines are quite common. Yes. Brain tumors are rare.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
Okay.
I think if you had some symptoms maybe that were different or changing, I mean, maybe like if you had, certainly if you had a seizure, vomiting, like some of the stuff I was talking about earlier, but that would be very uncommon.
So, Dr. Misios, in your experience, what are the most common presenting symptoms of a primary brain tumor?
It depends on the area of the brain that is involved. Tumors that are located along the front part of the brain typically don't present until they are too big in size, and they can present with behavioral changes, with memory difficulties. People start acting in very strange ways that are first picked up by their families. They are not aware of it. Tumors that are close to the motor cortex can present with seizures or weakness. Tumors that are located along the most posterior aspect of the brain can present with visual symptoms, changes in the vision, or people can see floating objects that are not there.
And that's a common phenomenon with migraine as well, you know, the visual obscurations. And
absolutely.
So.
Seizures is another common symptom. If the tumor is large and it's causing a lot of swelling in the brain, then people can present acutely with nausea, vomiting, headache, or obtundation. They can present very sleepy.
And that's basically because the pressure in the brain has gotten to the point where the brain is actually not getting enough blood supply.
Exactly. The skull has a fixed volume that accommodates the brain, and when the tumor grows into that, it starts pushing on the brain and it increases the pressure, and that causes the swelling, and that's when the symptoms start.
Dr. Wilkinson, if a patient was concerned that they might have a tumor that involves the spinal cord itself, what would be some of the symptoms that actually hold that answer? We have another caller coming in. We have Jane from Center, Texas. Jane, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
I was curious what the panel's experience has been with various presentations of chordoma.
Okay, various presentations of chordoma. Thanks, Jane, for calling. We were just talking about spinal cord tumors. What are the presentations of chordoma, Dr. Wilkinson? Is that something that you encounter in your practice?
Sure. So chordomas we think of as either being at the base of skull or potentially down into the pelvis and sacral chordomas. They are typically very infiltrative tumors that clearly require at least biopsy, but usually surgical resection first. And depending on the extent of surgery, which it sometimes can be difficult due to how infiltrative they are, we would require adjuvant therapy. One of the unique things about the chordoma histology is that from a radiation oncologist perspective is we need to use a much higher dose than average to treat a chordoma. There's great data out of Boston and Europe looking at high dose radiation in the form of proton therapy, which is above what we can deliver with standard conventional radiation, and that the control rates are much higher in the range of 85%, which for a chordoma is much lower with conventional radiation.
Again, this is Health Matters on Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. Our topic is neuro-oncology. We have three guests with us tonight. We have neurosurgeon Dr. Simeon Misios. We have medical oncologist Dr. Chip McDonald and radiation oncologist Dr. Ben Wilkinson. Dr. Wilkinson, you're talking about the chordoma. What's actually the most common tumor that affects the spinal cord? Is it going to be, in medical school we talked about different compartments of the spine that involve tumors, whether they were within the spinal cord itself or within the lining of the spinal cord or what we call extradural or outside of the lining of the spinal cord. What's the most common type of tumor that affects the spine? Is it usually from outside the spine pressing in or inside the spinal cord itself sort of pressing out?
So it really depends on the age group that we're looking at. If we're looking at the pediatric population or adult populations, and when we think of overall tumors involving the spine, you have to consider metastatic disease that's either going to come into the spinal canal or potentially into the bone that can then extend into the spine. Primary spinal tumors we think of as being ependymomas or glial-based as well. And depending to go to one of your earlier questions, what kind of symptoms we might see really depends on the level at which that this lesion might be. If you're up in the neck and the cervical spine, it's going to be above most of the branches that are going to affect the rest of the body, and we can have pretty devastating effects depending on where it is or how long the tumor has been in place. And depending if it's lower in the body, we might see symptoms in the lower portion of the body.
Very good. Dr. Misios, we had another question that was tweeted in. The listener wants to know, they had a family member that had what was called a grade 1 astrocytoma diagnosed in the occipital lobe when it was a 19-year-old woman. She was having increasing headaches, similar to what we discussed with Dr. McDonald a few minutes ago. And she wanted to know how often she should have that monitored, and if there was any risk that that would become a malignant tumor at some point, or what would the prognosis be for that particular tumor?
Yeah. So the gliomas are grouped into four major categories and based on their grade. And the grade is how aggressive we think a tumor will behave. And it largely depends on what the tumor looks like under the microscope. There are four grades, and the grade one are the least aggressive tumors. Grade four is the most aggressive tumor, a tumor we call glioblastoma. So a grade one glioma is the slowest growing tumor. It's the least aggressive type. And those are the tumors that we can safely resect. And if we are able to resect all of the tumor that's there, and if the postoperative MRI looks good, then the prognosis is great for the patient. If complete resection can be achieved, then the likelihood that the tumor will return is exceedingly low. However, sometimes, even though these tumors can be grade 1 tumors, they can still be in locations that do not allow us complete resection. And in that case, we try to remove as much as we can. And in that case, an MRI on a regular basis would be required to make sure that what tumor is left behind does not grow back. But the good thing with the grade 1 tumors is that they do not need any chemotherapy or radiation afterwards, unless there is residual disease that comes back and cannot be treated with surgery.
And this listener is mentioning that the young woman had the diagnosis of the grade 1 glioma in the occipital lobe. And so that's fairly expensive real estate, so to speak, right? So
it can be.
So it really depends on where the tumor is.
Yeah.
Dr. McDonald, we have another question that was tweeted in. And the question is, my loved one has a brain cancer and plans to try to work during chemotherapy. Is that possible? And what is the recovery time? Would that be detrimental to her recovery? Does stress, does physical activity affect one's response to chemotherapy if patients are able to tolerate it otherwise?
No. If patients want to work, then we encourage them to do so, unless there was some circumstance that would place them at danger. Maybe if they had a history of seizures, they should not be operating heavy equipment or something like that. But we have many patients who work while they are on chemotherapy with brain tumors and with other tumors as well. So that is fine, and that is actually encouraged.
We have another caller. We have Michelle from Shreveport. Michelle, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hi. I had a question. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what advances have been made in pediatric brain tumors as compared to other forms of pediatric cancer.
Thank you so much for that call. Dr. Misios, do you see children?
I do not. Okay. Our pediatric neurosurgeon at LSU sees most of the kids.
Dr. Wilkinson, what advances have you seen in terms of the treatment, diagnosis, and treatment of pediatric brain tumors?
Pediatric malignancies in general have been, one of our greater strides over the past 20 years in oncology. And it was not long ago that 20% of patients really were what we were talking about for long-term survivors, and now we're in the 80%, depending on the diagnosis, and sometimes higher. For pediatric brain tumors specifically, I think there's a lot that's gone into neuronavigation and being able to more safely remove tumors. It's great to have someone such as Christina Notoriani and Bharat Guthakanda that are here in town, being able to service pediatric patients as part of the St. Jude affiliation, as part of Dr. Misios' group. From a radiation perspective, proton therapy is really where we're going with treatment for pediatric malignancies, especially the CNS, but of all sites. primarily due from the potential for second malignancies that can happen, or second cancers after radiation, which sometimes can happen 8, 10, 12, 15 years later. And so whenever we can, if we have the ability to deliver proton therapy, we really try to in pediatric cases where we have to use radiation. So that's really one of the areas. Ongoing research is really helpful within the pediatric oncology group, or POG, of looking at where we can use radiation safely, use chemotherapy safely, and especially when we can de-escalate therapy. I think that's really the next phase of research within Children's Oncology Group, of looking at where we can reduce dose. As an example, it used to be the craniospinal radiation, which is a common form of radiation we'll give for pediatric brain tumors, such as medulloblastoma. When we would give radiation, it would be the entire brain to 54 gray, which is acknowledged as it being a very high dose, and then the spine to 36 gray, and there was a lot of exit dose coming through the heart, coming through the lungs, and in, unfortunately, female patients, through the developing breast tissue, leading to these malignancies down the road. Now we're reducing those doses and also essentially getting zero dose through the exit portion of the body. Just remarkable that we're able to do that now, where even 10 years ago we weren't.
Dr. McDonald, is that something that you see in terms of pediatric neuro-oncology? Is chemotherapy used in conjunction with radiation therapy, or is that something that has made much movement?
I don't see children, so I'm not going to be able to answer that question.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, within pediatric oncology, we think of it's pediatricians that go into oncology specific versus Dr. McDonald doing internal medicine first and then treating adults. And so here in Shreveport, we have two pediatric oncologists that specifically see patients as part of the St. Jude affiliation. Patients typically will go to St. Jude first in Memphis or be seen here locally, and then they'll come back. But we do very commonly use chemotherapy.
So is chemotherapy used to actually delay radiation or reduce the amount of radiation that's required in some of these tumors?
Yeah, both is what we do. Depending on the age of the child, we think about patients, especially if they're younger than 3 years old, we try to use chemotherapy to get them to an older age, because we know that the neurocognitive effects of radiation can be quite devastating on IQ over time. Even in the case of, we have one young lady that's 12 years old that's being treated right now at Willis-Knighton, and in her particular diagnosis, when patients are under the age of 10, we'd use chemotherapy to try to delay even over the age of 10. So it may not be for neurocognitive effects, but it's also for growth and development of the spine, for example.
Dr. McDonald, sorry, I didn't mean to spring the pediatric question on you. Let's get to an adult question. How's that?
Perfect.
This listener is asking, they had a family member that had a glioblastoma multiforme, and they want to know, is that a genetic problem? Is that something that they should be screened for? And if so, should they undergo some sort of screening for that? We know many tumors, colon cancer, breast cancer, yeah, can be quite hereditary. Do you see that in adults?
I do. There's a few different syndromes that can be associated with glioblastoma. The Lee from Mini syndrome, neurofibromatosis. There's a couple of others, von Hippel-Landau syndrome. I do a lot of genetic testing for hereditary cancer syndromes in my practice. For the ones that you just mentioned, those I have not seen one of those syndromes associated with a glioblastoma, but I know they're there. As far as screening for brain tumors or glioblastoma based on family history alone, that's generally not something that we do.
Another question about brain tumor risk factors was tweeted in as well. A number of years ago, and I believe it was probably during when the cell phone utilization became quite common, and so the cell phone manufacturers took a hit because there was this illusion of increasing brain tumors due to cell phone utilization. Is that something that any of you can speak to? Has that research been followed up? Because I don't think cell phone utilization is going down.
Yeah, I would say that doctors are going to be the first people to get brain tumors, if this happens. We do know that radiation is a risk factor for development of brain tumors. It comes from some of the early clinical experience of even using radiation for tinea capitis in Israel and other countries. And those patients, because of the penetrating effect of the type of radiation they use, would be more common to develop meningiomas, so benign tumors, in that time frame of kind of 8 to 15 or greater years afterwards. To my knowledge, and you know, some of the other panelists can speak to this too if they're aware, but there's nothing that's concrete that's linked the low dose of and the frequency of radiation that's affiliated the electromagnetic type of energy with cell phones. So right now, the recommendation is really we can't say not to use them. Of course, there's always ways to use them more safely, such as not texting and driving.
So you're probably more likely to wreck your car as a complication of cell phone use than get a brain tumor.
You know, the statistics probably aren't out there, but yes, let's try to be a little safer on the roads.
Yeah. Dr. Misios, are you aware of any research in terms of other environmental types of risk factors that may lead one to have an increased risk for primary brain cancer?
Well, I just wanted to add to the cell phone. Some of that data came from anecdotal reports of people developing a type of tumor that we call a low-grade glioma, and it was involving the temporal lobe, which is right behind the ear, and it was typically on the side where they held their phone up against. And the biggest studies that looked into that actually took place in Europe and Sweden in particular, and they looked at hundreds of people and they looked at the cell phone usage, and there was no direct association that was established. The amount of radiation from the cell phones is pretty low, and if someone is concerned, we always recommend that they can use the different headset, for example, or the earphones, but there's no direct association.
In terms of the radiation, Dr. Wilkinson, does the amount of radiation emitted by a cell phone vary according to the type of phone that you have? So if you have the latest mini tablet/smartphone, is that going to be different than the old flip phone, for example, or the amounts of radiation basically the same across different types of cell phones?
You know, I think we're going to have to phone a friend to Tim Cook at Apple to kind of find that out. I'm sure that one of the iterations that they're happening as they bring out the different more modern types of phones is that they are integrating the antenna into the body of the phone and trying to make it where it is safer to be used. If you're using a tablet and holding that up to your head, I mean, maybe there's problems there too, though.
Perhaps one of those frontal lobe tumors that Dr. Misios was warning us about. Another tweeted question, Dr. Misios, was the listener wanted to know, what is a schwannoma and what would be the symptoms of a schwannoma?
So a schwannoma is a benign tumor that is outside the brain, and it can involve both the spine as well as it can be inside the head but outside the brain, or it can involve the spine. And what a schwannoma is a benign tumor of the lining of the nerves. So if you think of the nerves like cables, there is the wire, the copper wire is the actual nerve itself, but there is a layer of, there are cells that surround the nerve, and they act like the rubber or the plastic in the cable. And those are called Schwann cells. Sometimes these cells do develop tumors, and they grow as little lumps around the nerve. And depending where they are, they can cause symptoms. When they present inside the head, the most common location for these involves the eighth cranial nerve, which controls hearing and controls balance. So a lot of times as they grow, they can cause someone to lose their hearing pretty quickly. Those are called vestibular schwannomas. But they can involve other cranial nerves as well. When they present in the spine, they can affect the nerve that they involve. So for example, if it's a nerve that involves the back, they can present with pain in the distribution of that nerve. About 95 to 97% of the time, these are benign tumors. There are malignant schwannomas as well, but they are exceedingly rare, and they are exceedingly difficult to treat when they do present.
Okay, very good. Thanks to all of our callers tonight. It's been a great response. Thanks to Michelle for that last question about pediatric tumors. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. Our topic tonight is neuro-oncology. I'm your host. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. Our guest tonight, we have a neurosurgeon, Dr. Simeon Missios with Louisiana State University School of Medicine here in Shreveport. We also have a medical oncologist as a guest, Dr. Chip McDonald from the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center, as well as radiation oncologist, Dr. Ben Wilkinson, also with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. And you can call us with a question, or you can tweet us. The phone number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet the question at RRR Public Radio. We have another question that was submitted online, Dr. Wilkinson. Do patients tend to have less long-term side effects after treatment with radiation versus actual surgery? So I guess we're asking, you know, is the damage caused by radiation to the brain residually greater or less than the damage that's caused to the brain by actually getting to a tumor and resecting it? Dr. Missios, please weigh in on that as well. I'm hoping that there's a debate to follow.
Well, I think I'm going to spoil your fun. You know, a lot of times when we're using radiation is that we're actually using it after surgery, and the side effects are different whether we're doing surgery or doing radiation. That being said, there are times where there's difficult tumor locations that we do choose to use radiation, maybe first after a biopsy, or potentially in that example of the meningioma, where we don't use a surgery at all if we're very convinced based on the imaging that we know what we're looking at. There are both short-term and long-term side effects with radiation, just as there are with any medical procedure. And so what we know, and whether it's surgery and trying to look at very minimally invasive techniques by Dr. Missios, or potentially radiation, whether we're choosing a platform such as Gamma Knife or proton therapy, our goal is always to reduce those side effects.
You know, Dr. Missios, you and I were speaking earlier about some of the new forms of treatment of cancers, and one thing that has really advanced over the years that we haven't talked about are anesthetic techniques, mm-hmm. and the ability to operate on the awake brain. Can you talk to us a little bit about how that, you know, brain sparing procedures and things along those lines, tissue sparing procedures and procedures where you're actually able to interact with the patient as you resect tumor, how that has advanced the field in your experience?
Absolutely. So one of the things we have gotten much better at as surgeons over the past 20, 30 years is doing the surgery in a safer manner, meaning to minimize morbidity, to minimize injury to the normal brain. And tumors that involve what we call eloquent regions, such as the motor cortex or the areas that control speech, used to be inoperable a few years ago. And imaging has gotten better. The ability to detect the normal brain versus the tumor has gotten better. But one of the best ways we have at doing this surgery safely is to actually do the surgery with the patient awake, which sounds completely bizarre and a very alien concept. And what that involves is the anesthesia input into that obviously is priceless. And what that involves is a use of special anesthetics that keep the patient relaxed, keep the patient sleepy, but able for us to wake the patient up in the operating room. So the patient does not have a breathing tube. And it's a fine balance between keeping the patient sleepy and preventing the patient from remembering the surgery, but again, being able to wake them up and interact with them during the surgery. But what that involves is, again, doing the surgery, and then at the critical portion, when we're working at the area of the brain that is close to the motor cortex or the speech cortex, then we wake the patient up and we ask them to speak, to read, to detect different shapes or objects, or to move their arms and legs. And then once the resection, we have ways to stimulate the area of the brain that we're going to work around, and stimulation of the area of the brain will cause the patient to temporarily stop moving or stop talking. And that's how we know where our borders are. That's how we establish our borders. That process is called mapping, brain mapping. So we start by doing that, and once we have our borders in place, we then proceed with the tumor resection, and then we let the patient sleep again for the rest of the procedure. It's not a procedure, it's something, it's a very important technique that we use for certain cases. We don't use that for every patient, of course. But again, for the patients that are that need it, it's a great way to do it and a very safe way to do the resection.
And in terms of the brain mapping, that's occurring intraoperatively with special navigation tools.
That's correct. That is correct.
We have just a few more minutes. If you want to get that last question in, it's 1-800-552-8502. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. The topic is neuro-oncology. Dr. Wilkinson, could you talk to us a little bit about any updates you might be able to provide our listeners with the immunology of brain tumors and spinal cord tumors in terms of immunotherapies that may be in the pipeline?
Yeah, I think a lot of our patients became excited with the release of some of the preliminary data from Duke University looking at injecting the poliovirus for patients with recurrent glioblastoma multiforme, or GBMs. And I think that all the panelists would say is that we don't have a good roadmap for what do we do when we have a recurrent GBM. Some of that initial data, I think, is promising, and the concept is that you can awaken the immune system to maybe what the immune system would say is definitely a foreign agent, and then by doing that, it can recognize that nearby abnormal cells or proteins may also be areas that need to be cleared by the immune system. So that's the hope. There's different ways of doing that. You can inject a foreign agent. There's even thought of using radiosurgery to be able to do that, of being able to create necrosis of the tumor, and by releasing some abnormal proteins that can further awaken the immune system. So, you know, further clinical research is needed, and we're hopeful because we, all three of us, I know, want to be out of business.
Dr. McDonald, we had one other question that was tweeted in. The listener wanted to know if there were any support groups or resources available for folks here locally that may be suffering with brain cancer.
At Willis-Knight Cancer Center, we do have a support group that meets on a weekly basis. It's not specific to brain tumors, but there is a support group there. We also refer patients to the American Cancer Society, where they have a couple of different programs hooking patients up with other patients or survivors or family members who have been in a similar situation. So either locally or through the American Cancer Society, that is available.
We actually have one more caller. We have Vaughn from Huntington, Texas. Vaughn, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call at the last minute. If one of your doctors had to suppose that a tumor would affect vision, where would it most likely be? On the optical nerve or behind the eye or the occipital lobe?
Vaughn, thank you so much for calling. We're going to answer that quickly, okay? Thank you so much.
It could actually be anywhere along that pathway, and it would present differently. So if it was a tumor that actually affected the optic nerve itself, we would expect it to present with blurry vision or changes in the visual acuity. If it was a little bit further back at the area of the optic chiasm, it could present as tunnel vision, so a restriction of the peripheral fields. Tumors of the pituitary present that way. It's a very typical presentation. If it's further back, it could involving the occipital lobe, then it typically presents as a something we call a homonymous hemianopsia. And what that is patients are limited. They cannot see the right or the left side of the world, both with the right and left eye. And that can present with the patient getting into an accident because they took a turn and they didn't see a car coming, or the patient bumping into a wall because they didn't see that it was there. Also, if the occipital lobe is affected, patients can see flashing bright objects in their field of view, which can be quite a bizarre symptom.
Thank you so much to Dr. Misios with LSU Neurosurgery. Thanks to Dr. Chip McDonald with Willis-Knight Cancer Center, as well as thanks to Dr. Ben Wilkinson. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. Consult your physician for health concerns. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio and is part of the Red River Radio's Community Connection series. Guests on Health Matters are not compensated and are selected by relevance to the topic. No fees are charged for participation in Health Matters. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance from Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Mr. Tim Snell. Health Matters is made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and also by Gamble Guest Care's Assisted Living Facility. Learn more at gambleguestcare.com. Next week, join us for Mental Health Matters, and the topic will be violence and violent tendencies. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us tonight.